Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up over the next half hour, how many planets boast double suns like the one in the old Star Wars film? The Vatican Observatory has been working together with NASA and leading U.S. astronomers to find out. And we stroll through the Vatican Gardens to see the Pontifical Academy of Sciences' magnificent headquarters and learn more about the prestigious institution's 400-year history. Vatican astronomers teamed up with NASA, the U.S. National Observatory, and a string of American universities in a recent project to investigate twin stars and planet formation. While the Earth has one star, the Sun, they wondered how many other planets might be out there with double suns. Two suns like those Luke Skywalker watches as they set on the horizon in the 1977 Star Wars film classic. Though the Vatican has its own observatory at the Pope's summer residence in hilly Castel Gandolfo outside Rome, the vastly expanded city has brightened the skies, making stargazing difficult for the Jesuit astronomers there. For this reason, in 1981, the observatory founded a second research center, the Vatican Observatory Research Group, based at the University of Arizona in Tucson. It was from there that the Vatican astronomers conducted their research in this twin star project. Vice Director of the Vatican's Tucson Observatory, Father Chris Corbelli, says there might be many planets where Luke Skywalker could gaze on a double sunset.
The suns for Luke Skywalker's people on his planet were very close together, not hugely far apart as we have been finding them, but they were very close together. And so the question is, was that a true depiction? As far as we can see, yes, it is. And it's not only true, but for those stars that are in doubles, that are twins, so together as they sort of go around each other in their lifetimes, then the tendency is to have planetary material, more planetary material, the closer they are together.
Talk about global warming. What would an extra sun do to the Earth's temperature?
It would certainly be hotter than a planet with just one sun, yes, because you'll have, let's say, twice the output of heat from two suns rather than one sun.
But it was the planetary material found near these stars that most interested Father Corbelli and his colleague Richard Gray of Appalachian State University in North Carolina. That's what they were working on when they were asked to join the project to investigate whether planets form around stars that are twins.
We obviously know that from our own solar system that we've got planets around our sun, which is a single sun. But if you've got double suns, are you going to get planets? And so that's the question. What's been found by the planet study of planets around other stars is that indeed about 50 out of the 200 planets that have been found around other stars are indeed around stars that are twins. But these stars are very far apart, very far. So how about stars that are much closer together, of which there are a whole bundle of these twin stars? Are you going to get planets? So that was the question.
The question that still puzzles astronomers like Father Corbelli, though, is what he calls the nature or nurture of planet formation. Like babies, are planets born with certain characteristics? Or is it circumstance, the environment, that makes them develop the way they do?
Someone characteristics? Are they, you know, what they are born with, or is it how they grow up that's the characteristics they have when they're an adult? So the same thing with these planetary material, this dusty and rocky material around planets. Is it, you know, the way they are born, and if their planets or suns are close together, then they'll have a lot of this dusty, rocky material? Or because they are close together, then they make a lot of dusty and rocky material as they go through their early lifetime? So this is still a question that's out there. We'll have to do some other investigations to try and get an answer to that. But so this is maybe an interest and a surprise in store.
So what surprises might these latest findings eventually lead to?
What we can know is that, forming planets seems to be much more, common after this study. So, yes, we knew that single stars like our own sun, probably have planetary material around them. Yes, we knew that, those fewer stars that are twins, that are very widely separated, also have planetary material around them. But now we know that, practically all twin stars, except those in a kind of an intermediate separation, do have this planetary material. So what it tells us is that the formation of planets in our universe is pretty darn common. In the order of 40% of the stars that we find seem to have this planetary material.
Researchers now have a better understanding about how our own solar system and planets came together. So where does this leave the Big Bang theory about how the universe came about? Are we any closer to finding out the real answer to one of humanity's greatest conundrums?
It certainly goes back to the story of how from the, the beginnings of the universe, the Big Bang, which, current best model, then we get to planets like our own Earth, and so life on these planets. And you were asking also about whether a planet with a twin star would be hotter. So what you'd need then for life is that a planet would have to be rather further away than our own Earth is from our own sun.
It's quite impressive, Father, that this is a joint project with so many important institutions in the United States. You presented this project to NASA. You were involved with the California Institute of Technology, the University of Arizona, so many different institutions.
National Observatory, yes.
Is it unusual that the Vatican does participate in such widely respected research projects?
Well, as usual, one comes into these things somewhat accidentally, but with other colleagues, including Richard Gray, who's from Appalachia State University, we've been interested in our neighbors, our neighboring stars for the last several years. And so we're doing a look-see, a survey of our neighbors. There end up around 3,600 stars that are within a certain distance out from our own sun, and we've been getting the good information about these stars. And because many of these stars were in the ones that this group were interested in investigating, that for the dusty, whether they had dust around them and rocky debris, then we were asked to, myself and Richard Gray were asked to join the project and contribute what we'd found out about our neighboring stars.
Now, you're a priest, a Jesuit priest, and I'm just curious to know how, when you go around, and I'm sure you give conferences and give talks at various institutions around the world about your research, do people look at you differently, strangely, because you're a priest and an astronomer at the same time?
For those who don't know the more than 400 years of the Vatican's involvement with astronomy, yes, that they will say, what? The Vatican has an observatory. For those who do, then it isn't a surprise. But as you say, for a lot of people, it's a surprise that the Vatican has this very professional involvement in astronomy.
How did you conduct this research on the suns? I mean, were you using special telescopes? Tell me more about that.
Well, the background data, which myself and my colleague Richard Gray did, were done with telescopes in the northern hemisphere and the southern hemisphere, so Earth-based telescopes, a very modest size. But we were getting very good and consistent data. So it's those that we input saying, you know, what to expect from an ordinary star on its own if we found it out there. Then what was the additional data that this team, the rest of the team were producing was data from a, I'm about to say satellite, but really it's a space observatory that lies some distance back from the Earth in our Earth journey around the Sun, called the Spitzer Telescope. And this is very sensitive in the infrared, or the heat region, of radiation. And it was looking with, as it were, this Spitzer telescope's eyes, its heat-sensitive eyes, that we're able to see the additional information that around these stars and see how what we expected from the data that Richard Gray and I gave, how the heat data differed from this, that then gave the clue that, yes, what we're seeing is the glow, the warmth, as it were, from this dusty debris.
Father Corbelly likes to call his twin stars neighborhood stars because they're right in our backyard, so to speak, just 200 light-years away. Though that might sound like a lot, it's not, especially when your galaxy's backyard is 100,000 light-years wide.
Which is really, you know, kind of the end of your arm as far as the space is concerned. So kind of reach out and feel around in your back garden and, you know, see what's in the neighborhood.
I came across, Father, a very interesting quote from the 17th century astronomer Galileo Galilei. I'm sure you're very familiar with that that name.
Who an interesting gentleman, certainly.
He was at odds with the church, of course, over his discovery that the Earth revolved around the sun. He said in this quote, and I'll just read it to you, "I do not feel obliged to believe that the same God who has endowed us with sense, reason, and intellect has intended us to forego their use." What do you make of that in today's context? And would you say that the church has matured in the way it approaches scientific research over the centuries?
Yes, so using sense, reason, and intellect is what we are asked to do by God. That's our God-given gifts. Now, what we've needed to learn is what's the appropriate use of these, you know, the sense, reason, and intellect in the various disciplines of study. So what's appropriate in theology and, say, the study of scriptures is not appropriate, or you're answering different questions in science. And obviously in Galileo's day, it was trying to distinguish what questions were appropriate for science and what questions were appropriate for theology. But that was the difficulty.
How does the astronomer churchman, Father Corbelly, feel about his own scientific work and his latest findings?
Just the joy of discovery. You know, what we do it for is obviously to find out these new things and to find the fascination of the universe in which, you know, God has put us. And so it's there's always a joy in this discovery. It's not a huge discovery that we make with, you know, the Spitzer telescope and with the Nearby Stars project of Richard Gray and myself, but it's another little sort of, you know, brick there in the whole, you know, wall of edifice, let's say, of our understanding. So it's fun to be part of. It's great too that the church, you know, is sensitive to this kind of discovery and to the joys of the universe, the joys which the Creator has given us.
You make me feel diminished in a certain way because I'm just sitting here in a studio and you've contributed in such a big way to a huge scientific discovery. Do you feel God's presence when you are doing this work?
One feels a connection, certainly, with God, because one's, you know, involved with God's creation. So there is a relationship there with the Creator. So yes, a lot of the work is obviously sometimes tedious, certainly very methodical, and doing things and needs concentration. But it's the times that you can step back, such as talking with you, and say, gosh, isn't it wonderful? And isn't it wonderful to learn that little bit more about our God-given universe?
Stargazer Father Chris Corbally, Vice Director of the Vatican Observatory Research Center in Tucson, Arizona.
Dear member of the Pontifical Academy of Sciences, I am especially pleased to greet you today as we celebrate the 400th anniversary of the Pontifical Academy of Sciences.
Pope John Paul II there in November 2003, welcoming in audience members of the Pontifical Academy of Sciences as the institution celebrated four centuries of activity here in the Vatican. The Academy, whose 80 international members include scientists, physicians, mathematicians, and sociologists, has been located since 1926 in a charming 16th century villa in the Hillside Vatican complex. Well, nestled in the heart of the rolling Vatican Gardens, the villa, known as the Casina of Pius IV, is an oasis of peace and academic debate in the midst of chaotic downtown Rome. Members are selected irrespective of their ethnic or religious background on the basis of their outstanding contribution to the sciences and their moral personality. The Casina was begun in the mid-1500s by architects Piero Ligorio and Sallustio Peruzzi, and is made up of four separate sections. Its two pavilions and two arched gateways are connected by a highly ornate oval inner court. The villa was recently restored to mark the Academy's landmark anniversary. But that ambitious restoration project could never have been undertaken without the help of the patrons of the Vatican Museums. Director of the Patron's Office, Father Alan Dustin, took me for a tour of the Casina to see the completed work. We're standing in front of the Casina, or inside the, what would you call this, the courtyard.
The courtyard, yes.
Of the Casina of Pope Pius IV, deep within the Vatican Gardens, up the hill, in fact, from St. Peter's Basilica, and looking over towards the Vatican Museums. The Casina is named after the 16th century Pope Pius IV, or Giovanni Medici, who was known for having accomplished a number of things during his pontificate, seeing the Council of Trent through to its conclusion, reforming the Roman tribunals, and the building of new palaces and churches in the Vatican and in Rome. Now, I understand that the Casina was begun in 1553 and took about 7 or 9 years to complete. Tell us more about the structure and why Pope Pius wanted to construct it.
Well, to begin with, it was begun under Pope Paul IV. And when Pius IV came to the papal throne, he then continued the construction, and it was under him that it was finished. Most of the decoration you see here, which includes stucco and mosaic and many ancient Roman statues that were already in the Vatican, were put in place under the decorative scheme of Piero Ligorio, who was from Naples, was brought here by Paul IV, and then continued under Pius IV to complete the Casina. It's set in what was known as the Boschetto, or the woods of the Vatican Garden. And actually, if you think about what was here in the Vatican then, in the latter part of the 16th century, you'll see that the axis of the Casina allowed the Pope to look at two important places. His summer residence, which was the Palace of Innocent VIII, and the Apostolic Palace, in which he, as well as many of the other popes, resided. So this was sort of the apex of a triangle of palaces of the popes in the Vatican. This particular palace was never used as a residence, however. It was more a small retreat for the pope or members of the papal court, and often not only religious retreats, but concerts were held here, poetry readings, and learned discussions. But again, this was for him during the ordinary year, because it was not a residence, but rather a place to come for quiet and solitude within the complex and the complexity of the Vatican.
It really, in a way, is a charmingly small villa. It gives you the idea of warmth, of welcoming in. As we're standing here in the courtyard, we can hear the fountains going there in the background. You can see the dome of St. Peter's over here on the left. But, you know, one thing that really strikes you as you're looking at this facade here, there are so many allusions to mythology and to pagan imagery. Why is that? Why do we find that in the Vatican, in the heart of Christianity?
Well, the model for this was a Roman villa of pre-Christian times. So naturally, much of the iconography from those ancient villas, like you would find at Tivoli or other places in the Roman countryside, were also illustrated here. Most of what you see, though, are the muses, so they refer to the arts. And this was a place also where poetry and music and other sorts of arts, probably dramas, were put on for the Pope and the papal court. So it would be not so unusual that these figures would represent that ancient tradition of the arts.
Now, going into the building from this courtyard, you immediately find yourself inside of a sort of a nymphaeum. Now, why a nymphaeum?
Well, again, because it was typically a part of an ancient Roman villa.
In ancient Greek and Roman architecture, a nymphaeum was a monument consecrated to the nymphs or goddesses of fresh water springs or the sea. Originally, these monuments were made out of natural grottos where nymphs were believed to have lived. Roman villas often boasted a nymphaeum, many of which attempted to imitate a grotto. These were curved in shape and adorned with fountains and pools. Other decoration commonly included statues, paintings, and mosaics depicting water and sea creatures.
Piero Ligorio wanted all of the senses to be used. That's why you not only hear the fountains, but there are several fountains that are visible, including this one in the center of the courtyard. And a nymphaeum usually was a place where there was water, so you would hear that and see it as well. But once you step beyond the octagonal courtyard here into the building itself, the iconography changes to Judeo-Christian tradition, and most of the frescoes illustrate such things as the days of creation and then moving into the New Testament and the life of Christ and the Virgin. And there is also a chapel inside, which has no pagan images in it.
Now, how long did the restoration take, and how does the Holy See actually finance these sort of restoration works?
The complete restoration, in this case, it was very complete because it was from the roof to the foundations, was about a 3.5-year project. And this was funded thanks to a foundation in New York through the patrons of the arts and the Vatican Museums. One of the main objects of our patrons is to help with conservation and restoration, and this was a natural place for them because it is so beautiful and it involves all the senses. And it really was not a problem finding someone to pay for the conservation and restoration of this.
The Casino, of course, is now home to the Pontifical Academy of Sciences. How did that come about?
In 1931, I believe, Pope Pius XI decided to revive the ancient academy of the Lince. And when he did, he gave them this building within the Vatican City-State as the seat for the Pontifical Academy of Sciences, which today is also the seat for the Pontifical Academy of Social Sciences. And at that time, then, an addition was added to the back, which today are the meeting rooms of the academies.
In a way, you don't notice quite the difference between the architecture. The addition seems to be very much in harmony with the rest of the building.
It is, and it actually, standing here in the courtyard, you really can't see the addition. So it was a very clever way of disguising it. It also goes further back into the Vatican Hill, of course, than where we're standing in this courtyard.
I myself have been here in this courtyard interviewing people from United States astronauts to world-renowned Nobel Peace winners, neurologists, famous physicians, and so on. It's really an extraordinary place that has drawn people from all sorts of professions from all over the world, hasn't it?
Definitely, and of course that's due to the Pontifical Academy of Sciences, but I can't help but think that all of these scientists that are members of the Academy, when they're in this courtyard, are also moved by the beauty of the art and its location here in the Vatican. There is a bit of a link between the history of this building and the Academy of Sciences, in that in the 18th and into the beginning of the early 19th century, planted around the Academy was the papal herbal garden, where people did study, in fact, the medicinal properties of plants and other uses for them. And eventually, this area became part of the Department of Botany of the University of La Sapienza, which became then the University of Rome. So there is a tie-in all from the beginning, really up to the present day, of the location at least. It is really one of the most magnificent complexes of buildings. Someone has called it a symphony of the arts because there's architecture, sculpture, mosaic, fresco, all within this very small complex.
And that wraps up our tour of the Casina of Pope Pius IV, home today of the Pontifical Academy of Sciences. My thanks to Father Alan Dustin, director of the Vatican's Office for Patrons of the Vatican Museums. And if you're here in Rome and want to see the Vatican Gardens, where the Casina is located, there's a booking office on the left-hand side of St. Peter's Square. Just look for the post office. And if you'd like to find out more about the projects and activities of the Vatican's Patrons Office or become a member, just log on to their website. That's www.vaticanpatrons.org. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.